This is a CNA podcast.
What are your hopes for Singapore's relationship with foreign workers going forward?
Humane and fair treatment. They're people just like us.
Seeing workers with dignity, with value and respect.
This is Heart of the Matter, and I'm Lin Su Ling. In a future retelling of Singapore's struggle with the COVID-19 pandemic, an unmissable story arc would be the sheer number of infections among the migrant worker population. As it stands, close to 90% of Singapore's total infected are men on work permit passes living in dormitories. The government has moved swiftly to rein in the spread by isolating, testing, and treating scores of infected, picking up the tab for their medical costs and keeping them employed. As cases ease, the government is looking toward a more long-term solution, in particular, how workers are housed in a way that will prevent another public health crisis like this one. Earlier this week, the multi-ministry task force announced a major building program to construct new dormitories and repurpose unused sites on Monday, some of which Minister Lawrence Wong highlighted may be close to residential areas. Has there been a change in heart in Singapore's approach to housing foreign workers? What else, if not, explains this move? And the difficult but necessary question, are Singaporeans truly ready to welcome foreign workers into our neighbourhoods? Joining me to tackle these issues are Gillian Koh, Deputy Director of Research at the Institute of Policy Studies.
Good morning, Su Ling.
And Michael Chia, Executive Director of HealthServe.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Hi, everybody. Let's start by taking a step back. What happened to the old approach of setting standards and forcing against errant operators of dormitories? Take us through how Singapore housed foreign workers before COVID-19 struck and outline what the coronavirus did to shine the spotlight on this model. What are your thoughts, Michael?
Thanks, Su Ling. If we were to take a step back, the new designs of all dormitories started after the 2011 riot, if you recall. So you started seeing big dormitories that were set up, they were built, they were having an infrastructure, they had a self-contained RC per se, where they provided the necessary amenities. Some even have cinemas inside, there were some bowling alleys that I know of. All these were designed and built just for the purpose of having quarantine all the migrant workers towards their dorm and having them stay in there. For that particular design, it has worked to a certain degree. It helped the workers to be able to say that, okay, this is a place where I can rest. This is a place where I can get most of my needs. I'm able to have all the necessary recreational things that I hope to do, wish to do. They have, to a certain degree, have called some of the dormitories home for a long period of time. For pre-COVID, that has always been a place where they think, okay, this is a place that I can rest, this is a place I can be in, and it's good. It was good for them.
But the sheer number of violations that Minister Josephine Teo have highlighted in Parliament and elsewhere, so many of them didn't adhere to all these standards that were being laid out. Why do you think that's the case? And what's your take on where we erred?
The violations and all that really matters when it comes to the dollars and cents, right? Dormitories started looking to what matters. At the end of the day, it became a business for them. P&L was a very important thing. They started squeezing in more workers to a room. They started trying to make sure that they can remain profitable. They can be earning a lot more. I think that's what probably has started the whole thing. The original design and intent of the dormitory was to really have a place called home for the workers. When that was removed and becomes business, then there's a lot of things that will not follow through.
So, Gillian, what's your take?
Well, I think that if you have been in Singapore, you will have indeed noticed that the government, through the Ministry of Manpower, had been actually surveilling, monitoring living conditions in these purpose-built dormitories. Every now and then, you will have in the news an item that says that there was a tip-off, that there had been overcrowding in rooms in the dorms. And actually, there had been no specification in terms of the number of beds you could have in a room, although the key specification in the previous protocol was that each resident would be allocated at least something to the order of 4.5 square meters per resident. That's one point. The second point is indeed there was an effort to move the foreign workers out of just some central areas in the city because it was actually also very, very crowded. You'll see them on the weekends doing what was necessary, remitting money, having some recreational time, having their favorite foods in Little India. So it was very, very crowded. with the dispersion to these dorms and hopefully making them self-contained so that all the services and amenities are available, then you are trying to decentralize this spread of the migrant workers. And in that case, then there would still be a lot of clustering within the dorms, so there'd be a lot of mingling, but it's a lively hub for them. The question is, if we wanted to make this situation more pandemic-proof, then you have to think about the watering holes, so to speak, for these workers. And when need be, they can then actually go back into even smaller clusters and take care of themselves better without needing to go to centralized locations to do what they need to do.
So when COVID-19 struck, is the sense that the dormitories were a perfect storm? What is your response to people who say, surely the warning signs were there? We need to take steps to prevent a further deterioration of the situation. And we really got lucky with the Seletar Aerospace cluster contained in February, but that should have been the wake-up call. What reasonably do you think could have been done better then?
What could have been done better was perhaps to really provide the care towards the migrant workers early on stage. During the time, if you recall, workers were not the main priorities to be either swabbed or to be isolated to a certain degree. Though there were a lot of information given, but no one actually went down to the dormitories, no one actually went and sat down and explained to the workers the importance of physical distancing, the importance of keeping a good hygiene. When the first cluster that came into the dormitories, what could have been done better was that information towards the dorm operators and the workers to be informed. Workers are very willing to be involved in getting the solutions out early on stage. It's just that they were not informed. They didn't really know what was going on. All they were told is that, please stay in this place. There will be some people coming to help you. There will be some people swabbing you.
But it's sounding like what you're saying is that the Seletar Aerospace cluster was a blind spot. But I recall that when that happened, our hearts all skipped a beat. We thought this could really materialize into something bigger. Was this a blind spot, Gillian?
Well, I think that the wheel started churning in terms of thinking about how you would then disperse the migrant workers who are clustered in the dorms, right? And you've seen that it actually takes time because Singapore is so dense and everything is so densely put together that there is not really a lot of redundant space to find and to really set up structures in advance of anything like this happening. You've seen this quick conversion of big exhibition halls. You've seen now even tentage set up in the old part of the port. Even if you had the first cluster, you still need time to do that. Quite soon after the recognition that there was a new cluster within the dorm, I think April 1st, April 2nd, April 3rd, you had the announcement of the circuit breaker measures that would be applied nationally right across Singapore.
Speaking of circuit breakers, is your sense that the foreign worker dormitory clusters the chief reason why Singapore pulled the circuit breakers in the first place? The week before, there were a couple of clusters. When PM Lee's address, he also highlighted several worrying clusters at foreign worker dormitories apart from one nursing home.
Yes, I think you have to look at right across Singapore, there are some of these very densely put together people groups. And you see the elder care centres, that's a worry. Then certainly the migrant worker dorms are key because they are there in the workplaces spread across Singapore. So the exposure will be very high. If you pull them out, you will really be closing businesses. If you close businesses, then you're telling people you really need to stay home for these reasons. So I think it added up to why a circuit breaker was needed. But also there were very many unlinked cases at that time. Of course, now, after the investigations, they may not be unlinked anymore. But at that time, you're talking about 40 or so unlinked cases just before the circuit breaker was instituted. It's really about planning that space that really requires time. And so no matter how quickly you react when you have the infections, then that's already a bit too late and you have to press the pause price button right across the board. Now, of course, we see in the new specifications for dorms, more beds in sick bays and more redundant space or space provided so that there will be isolation spaces for sick foreign workers.
So that's great. And it's a good time for us to shift gears to talk about the announced move on Monday. And Michael, what's your take on what the implications are of government taking on a bigger role in building, possibly even owning, leasing and operating these dorms, or involving, you know, NGOs, VWOs, other than the private sector? Would you call this a paradigm shift from how it's being done all these years?
It's definitely a change. For one, I think having the government builds and owns the asset and lease out to other organizations to rent it, to a certain degree, it does bring a step forward. But the importance of the whole thing is down to the dollars and cents that most Singaporeans are worried about as well. Anyway, if this is going to be so, and if the government is going to take over this whole thing, we have to probably have to wait and see what will the cost pricing be like for every dormitories, like how much is it going to be to a room.
But is it clear to you what the chief objective of this move is? Because on one hand, while Minister Josephine Teo said it's important to pandemic-proof a dorm to reduce the risk of transmission and be able to respond more effectively in the future, Lawrence Wong talked about the longer-term overall plan about reducing density, conjuring up the initial narrative of crowded dorms and cramped living conditions that need to be solved. So which one is it? What is the chief objective to you?
I think it's both. If we were to have a place where space is definitely better, I think for a worker to be able to really rest well, to be pandemic-proof in future, that is all the necessary things moving forward and being planned into.
But this is such a huge undertaking. Gillian, do you see this as a step towards some sort of a nationalization model? In the same way that, you know, the government has a bigger role in public transport, taking over SMRT assets and the bus contracting model, even enhancing places in preschool.
Well, let me refer you to a very considered paper put out by Transient Migrant Workers Count 2, the non-government organization that addresses migrant worker issues at the policy level. What they've explained is this, that for them, of course, they have more generous specifications, what they feel is needed for the migrant workers. And it amounts to, in their plan, about a 67% increase in terms of space per person. And they say, well, how do we square the circle? We need space for management of health risk, but of course, costs will go up by the same factor of 67%. And they put their finger on the fact that the leases for the current set of dorms are just 3 years plus 3 years. And so it's very, very difficult for any operator to do this on a market model to recoup that first investment of developing such a setting. Even the current model is too difficult, although TWC2 has also said that there's quite a lot of revenue being raked in and profits too. The ministers have said that they are exploring many different business models, and one is possibly for the government to actually set it all up and then allow for just tenders to run the dormitory. So there has to be different models to work it out, but it's all these parameters that make a difference, but it's doable. Having said that, the new specifications are not as generous as what TWC wanted. But the key thing is this, that you really, as Michael pointed out, need to ensure that the workers do not have that many people share one toilet. Right now, it's one set of toilet, bathroom and sink to 15 people. The new improved specification be one toilet, bathroom and sink to 5 people. So that would be a significant improvement. The government will pick up the tab to some extent, it says, but it's looking at how business and perhaps even the workers paying a little bit more.
But if standards are a huge part of this, the other side of the coin is that Minister Lawrence Wong had acknowledged the most crucial part of this build, lease, operate model is the management itself, where dorm operators continue to fall short of at least half of them violate standards already set. So, Michael, where do you see government's key role versus the rest in this public-private people partnership?
The governance of it should be critical, and allowing the, firstly, sufficient space for a dorm operator to manage it well, and also, however, to be held accountable should they not follow through. If you were to just take a step back as well and ask the questions about why this whole thing started in the first place and why some dorm operators are so willing to just
take advantage of this whole situation. Perhaps one of it we can consider is because migrant workers have never been in the limelight for many things. And most of the times, workers don't really highlight, they don't really complain. They never make a request when a dormitory owner or dormitory operator shortchange whatever things that they're supposed to have.
Why do you think that's the case?
Well, for every single migrant worker that comes to Singapore, their number one fear is being repatriated back home. Most of the time, I'm not sure if you're aware, a migrant worker needs to actually pay an agent fee just to come to Singapore to work. And some of them pay as high as $15,000 just to be here. A recent case, and this is someone I just spoke to very recently, he just on his last agent fee, he actually paid $8.5K. And I was asking him, why do you do that? And what motivated you? It's all really just for a possible position to be able to provide for their families back home. So he's willing to take this risk, though the risk is high, and come to Singapore just to earn something for their families back home. And I asked him a question about, like, do you realize that you actually have to pay someone just to work for that person? And you're probably not going to earn back this money for another 2.5 years or so. His eyes just littered and he says, yeah, and I never saw it that way. But yes, that is what happens to every single migrant worker. It's kind of sad if you think about it, that every single person, in order to get a job, you pay for the job just to be able to work for the job. It's a bit strange to me, actually.
Well, now that you mentioned that, I want to zoom out a little bit and move into the responses to the Monday announcement so far. While there seemed to be a chorus of voices calling for something to be done in the initial stage, when the scale of the outbreak in the dormitories were first apparent, curiously, responses to the announcement of this new approach to the government building dorms and locating them possibly to some residential areas, responses have been mixed, even negative, over the costs and location of the dorms. Are you both surprised? And why do you think that's the case?
I think after what we've been through, there's a greater segment of Singaporeans who are more appreciative of what the foreign workers do, are more appreciative of the difficulties and challenges of working in Singapore, and more appreciative of the need to do more to treat them as equals. With the announcement, there will be more people today who would welcome the improvements than there would have been pre-COVID, that's for sure. But I think the segments that are a little ambivalent or even negative about it would be those who are saying, well, what do we do about these people, so many of them, in my neighborhood? Will my neighborhood be swamped? Will it change the cultural landscape or just literally the physical landscape of my neighborhood? And we've seen this before. This phenomenon of not in my backyard reared its ugly head many years ago in Serangoon Gardens, and it was very, very unpleasant. And people are firstly concerned about crowding of their neighborhoods, traffic, how do these people get in and out? So I think what you've seen is that there are political office holders who said, we are aware of those issues. We will manage those so that right now, at least during this COVID season, but I suppose coming out of it, there'll be more care about who can leave those dorms anyway, because there's the issue of health. So you can see that there's still now a very strict regimen which will be carried on for testing of health status. And then foreign workers need a green screen on their health app to prove that they can leave. When they leave, the employers have to make sure that there is provided transport to take them out directly to their workplaces, and then they're taken back directly to the dorms. In a way, there is very controlled interaction, in fact, almost no interaction with the local population. But that is, on the other hand, somewhat regrettable. If in the post-COVID new normal, we can think about ways in which there is some social interaction. Third places where foreign workers, they are as human as we are. They're creative, they have recreational needs, and this is where the local population can meet and interact with them. My final point is, when you look at the dispersal of the planned purpose-built dorms as well as the unused state properties where these workers will be housed, and they're only going to be sent there if they're cleared in terms of health status, they're scattered all over the island. So there's no point saying, not in my backyard. Singapore is very small. There is no backyard. Everybody is sharing the same space, really. When you look at the dispersal dispersal. There's not many other places you can put them. And realize the foreign workers are also living in places that are not dorms, and they are already within our neighbourhoods.
So two questions to both of you. I think most Singaporeans do agree and appreciate the contributions of our foreign worker community, but is welcoming them into our neighbourhoods a bridge too far for Singaporeans? I really wonder what happened to the voices that called for better, more humane treatment, treating them like everyone else. Isn't this the integration that we wanted, or is mixing too much to ask of Singaporeans?
You can't do it in one step. And the thing is, who's going to start? But you see the little initiatives, for instance, migrant workers having their poetry published, very small niche type interaction. You see the foreign workers playing cricket sometimes in open spaces. What's to stop us from going there and continuing the interaction we've had during COVID to sort of more normal type activities? I think this is where the NGOs play a part, but also the rest of us really see that there's so many facets to them that we can better appreciate. And it's just got to take time, but the effort and the will to do it.
Michael, if you could weigh in here, NIMBYism has a history in Singapore, like what Gillian mentioned, but it involved old folks' homes in the past and seniors as part of our community, as families even, is something that a lot of Singaporeans understand. But now this new form of NIMBYism involving foreign workers, how different or similar do you think these two are?
Similar to a certain degree, but different in the sense that this is a totally different nationality and they are not Singaporeans. And therefore, I think they are viewed even probably a little bit lower than the other two that you mentioned earlier on. I think I agree with what Gillian said. This is not a one-step method and that it can be solved overnight. It really will take effort. It does take time. This NIMBYism and all those things, though understandable, it has been there. There's a history of it. Serangoon Gardens definitely came to mind. I remember the incident as well. And just talking to the locals there and their concerns and their fears, valid concerns, but not necessarily right. If you were to just take a step back and think, what does Singapore really, really want? And what do we want Singapore to really be? I think this is an important question for all of us to be moving forward together.
Rounding off this podcast, the question also of reducing reliance on foreign workers come up perennially every year. Mm-hmm. But this time round, do you sense a shift? Now, on Monday, Minister Indrani did come out to say Singapore will have to find ways to reduce that reliance on foreign workers. Is there a sea change?
I think this has been a campaign for at least two decades now. And I think the business leaders are saying that they're taking a look at it, but they put out a statement to say that the activities do require that number, but it's a certain skill level and it's a certain type of work that local workers are not interested in. So they're actually plugging a gap. If we're actually building the infrastructure that we want, more flats, more MRT stations, and certainly now these new dorms to house workers, which we feel in our hearts is the right thing to do, then don't we need even more construction workers? But it's for a period of time. And then the broader sweep is really to see how you can reduce the need for them through automation.
But how realistic is that? Because we have a very tight labour manpower situation. So I'm wondering where the jobs will be cut from.
There are no local workers to be found to do this. And you automate, there's even a shrinking population that's in the working age.
Exactly.
So we all have to decide we need less, we need fewer flats, we need fewer things, perhaps. So that would be one huge cultural change that we will need to make if that's the case. But policy-wise, you've seen that the levies for foreign workers has been going up and it's making it more painful for businesses to take them in, which makes them more reflective and considered in terms of what is the number they actually need. Then on the other side, the carrot is that the government's giving a lot of incentives to automate, to innovate, so that there's no need for a leap in numbers, but a gradual increase really because we want more and we have less local workers.
It's really, really important to just understand that there are certain jobs, there are certain requirements that we can't really automate. And we have to acknowledge that. And if no one else will want to do the job, then who will? And I think if we were to just look into this and understand that the community of migrant workers play an important part in just supporting not just businesses, it actually supports Singapore's lifestyle, it supports Singapore's clean and green city. It supports everything that we like about Singapore. just driving around the streets, I mean, we haven't had our grass cut for a few weeks, and look at how unkept it is. And then you realize how important it is for just a group of people needing to just ensure that these things are being done. If Singapore don't acknowledge that, or even not wanting to just have any reliance on that, then we have to find an alternative solution, which I don't think it is possible. It's very hard to automate something to cut the grass, if you can imagine. It's so impossible to just trim the trees. And how do you do such things?
Thank you, Gillian and Michael, for joining us today. There you have it from the experts, the big questions about Singapore's relationship with foreign workers. I'm Lin Suling signing off. The team behind this podcast are Crispina Robert, our podcast editor, and research writer Erin Lowe.